The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in these articles that we're going to be reading. They are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. In our previous episode of Armchair Traveler, you may recall that we featured part one of Notre Dame after the fire. This is the cover story from the February 2022 issue of National Geographic. Today, we continue with part two. Writer Robert Kunzig continues to explore how the restoration of the fire-damaged cathedral in Paris will seek to honor its medieval roots as work continues to return Our Lady, which is how it's translated, to its historic majesty. Now, before we begin, I'm going to take a moment to recall some of the people who were introduced to us in part one, and you may hear their names mentioned again in part two, so at least you'll know who they are. Philippe Villeneuve is the chief architect for the restoration of Notre Dame. And then we have Eugène Emmanuel Viollet-le-Duc. Now, he was the man who led a 20-year restoration of Notre Dame following a fire that occurred in 1831. Keep his name in mind again because he'll come up again. That's Eugène Emmanuel Viollet-le-Duc. Now, we have Philippe Gourmand, a forestry expert, and he oversees the Forest of France and efforts to replace charred beams, trusses, and other wooden structures that are part of the cathedral structure. And then we have Jean-Louis Jourgelin. Now, he's a retired five-star general who was called by French President Emmanuel Macron to manage the cathedral's reconstruction. He's kind of a co-leader in all this. And then there's Jean-Michel Lignard. Now, he is a historian of architecture and a consultant in the restoration of Notre Dame. Now, in order to kind of get us back up to pace, I'm going to read the last paragraph that we finished with last week. It's very short, and I just want to share with you some points it makes. Today, most French restorers wouldn't think of undoing Viollet-le-Duc did. Remember, he was the one that reconstructed everything following the fire in the early 1800s. Moulin thinks that's a shame. He believes in preserving history, too, but trying to fix a building once and for all in its last known state, he said, amounts to declaring that history has ended for that building. It's the definition of death, and it may not be what's best for preservation. If the roof of your cathedral just burned off, Moulin argued, it doesn't make sense to rebuild the rafters out of wood. Now, that argument was heard and dismissed at Notre Dame. The forest and the spire will indeed be built of wood, though with more fireproofing and with fire-suppressing misters. The details are still being worked out. So there you go. That's how we ended last week. So let's begin with part two today of Notre Dame after the fire. In 2019, the fire raging through the oak timbers got so hot, almost certainly more than 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit, that it ate into the adjacent limestone walls and into the tops of some vaults. Two stone specialists at the Monuments Lab, geologist Lise Cadeau-Leroux and conservation scientist Jean-Didier Mertz, trained as rope technicians so they could inspect the damage. Mertz showed me some foot-long cores they extracted from the two-foot-thick stones. The surface of some stones turned to powder, and fissures formed inside, causing as much as 4 inches to peel off. But most of the blocks appeared to have remained thick enough to do their job, Mertz said. He and his colleagues developed a technique for sealing the fissures by injecting a lime slurry. Now, for the stones that need replacing, scientists are searching for good matches north of Paris. The city has grown over the medieval quarries, which were then on its outskirts. Most of the 507 tons of lead in the roof and spire simply melted and rained into the church. But the heat was intense enough to launch lead particles into the smoke. The danger from inhaling that lead might... That night, unless you were standing right by the fire, was negligible, said Jérôme Legrand, a doctor and toxicologist who directs the Paris Poison Center at the Labourdieu-Fernand-Vidal Hospital. The real danger with lead is that it will be ingested accidentally over time, especially by children, via contaminated dirt in parks or playgrounds or dust that settles inside homes. Alexander von Gien, a Columbia University scientist who walked around Paris spooning dirt samples into paper bags, estimated that about a ton of lead had fallen within a kilometer of the church. But there's no evidence it caused significant poisoning, Legrand said. He and his colleagues analyzed blood from 1,200 children in the affected area. They found concentrations above the level of concern in a little over 1%, about the same as in the French population at large, and much less than in the U.S. In every case, moreover, an investigation revealed that the children routinely were exposed to other sources of lead. Many Paris balconies, for example, have lead floors. Still, no amount of lead in the blood is considered safe, and lead roofs pollute the environment whenever they are worked or rained on. In February 2021, a science advisory board to the health ministry, of which Legrand was a member, recommended that France ban lead in new roofs and that alternatives to its use in historical restoration be found. The city, Paris City Council, by then had voted to demand that Notre Dame not be re-roofed in lead. None of this has diminished Villeneuve's determination. To be endangered by a lead roof on Notre Dame, both he and George Lynn insisted children would have to climb onto it and lick it. Lead is an absolutely essential element in the construction, Villeneuve argued. Sure, the Cathedral de Chartres has a copper roof, but copper turns green and paraff roofs are gray. Most are zinc, but only lead could reproduce the spire and sculpted ornamentation of Notre Dame's roof. Lead already covers the Pantheon, the Invalides, and the other monuments. Villeneuve said, why shouldn't the cathedral be the only victim of the madness of these lead fundamentalists? Rainwater running off a new roof will be captured and filtered. Villeneuve also plans to rebuild the timber framework exactly as it was. It had two distinct parts. When Viollet-le-Duc rebuilt the spire, he replaced the framework of the transept, and not in a medieval way. The beams were cut off industrial sawmills. Villeneuve will do the same. Last winter, Gaumont coordinated the donation of 1,200 oaks from all around France. The largest, oldest ones had been planted just before the French Revolution by royal foresters who were safeguarding the Navy's supply of ship mast. These trees will serve as the base of the spire. The attic timbers of the nave and choir were different. They were mostly original from the 13th century. In September 2020, a group called the Carpenters Without Borders reconstructed one of the triangular trusses in front of the cathedral to demonstrate the feasibility of rebuilding the framework in the medieval way. Francois Cayam, an ethnologist and carpenter who founded the group, took me to see that truss where it is now on display outside the medieval fortress in Normandy called the Chateau de Croqueville. It consists of a dozen beams, each hand-hewn from a single oak, no more than a foot across. Medieval carpenters worked their wood green, and so did Carpenters Without Borders. They followed the grain, keeping their heart at the center. That gave some of the beams a gentle curve, but it made them stronger. The trusses at Notre Dame stood for more than 800 years before their luck ran out. Cayenne pulled from the trunk of his car the tool of choice, a douillet, a broad axe with a head flared like a trumpet. He took a few skillful whacks at a log, then let me have a go. The axe, he warned, was sharp enough to inflict serious injury if aimed poorly, which seemed a distinct possibility. My first blows glanced off the log with an alarming clang, but then I landed a few. Thin wedges of fresh wood flew into the air. In Cayenne's view, historical restoration should be about restoring lost skills as well as damaged buildings, and not just for the benefit of carpenters. The reason Notre Dame's forest left such an impression on people who saw it, he thinks, is that the message was passing across the centuries from the master artisans who made it. The framework was 800 years old. It's gone. But I think that if we rework it the way it was worked, in the same manner and with the same materials, the message can be transmitted, Cayenne said. We'll be able to feel it. Villeneuve was impressed by the demonstration by Carpenters Without Borders. To save time, he said, sawmills will trim the logs for the nave and choir, but the beams will be finished by hand with Doyez. Now, construction of the spire will come first. However, Viollet-le-Duc had to break a hole in the vault so he could build his spire from the inside. Villeneuve has a head start. The hole's already there. Maurice Desoulets, The Bishop of Paris, who commissioned Notre Dame in 1163, was the son of peasants, while the spire strained toward heaven. Sully's aspirations were worldly as well. He was showing off his power to his rivals as well as the king. The tower, on the archbishop's palace looked like a castle battlement. The cathedral's west facade was even more massive. In the medieval city, it was completely dominant, crushing, said Bernard von Cany, who, as chief architect, restored the facade in the 1990s, removing decades of car exhaust and pigeon poop. I was living in France then and remember that rebirth, how the walls glowed when the scaffolding came down. Construction of the cathedral was financed mostly by donations from ordinary people, said art historian Danny Cendron of the Sorbonne. Their experience of the church was not that of Catholic mass-goers today, milling about in the chairless nave. They couldn't see and could barely hear the services held by the resident canons 8 times a day behind a wall in the choir. In the side chapels, chaplains whispered some 120 masses a day, but those too weren't really for the living. They were for the affluent dead who had endowed masses in perpetuity in hopes of boosting their souls out of purgatory. Nevertheless, ordinary people flocked to Notre Dame. They sometimes slept on the floor before an altar, dreaming of miraculous cures for painful diseases. Catholic faith was vital to most French people then. It isn't now. Notre Dame is not a museum, Patrick Chauvet, the cathedral's rector, insisted. Before the fire, some 3,000 people came to Mass on Sundays, but 10 to 12 million tourists visited each year. Many had scant knowledge of Christianity. How can they be touched by the grace of this place, Chauvet asked. How can the beauty of this place perhaps at least interrogate them on the meaning of their lives? The plan, he said, is to recurate the visit. When the church reopens, visitors will be ushered into a new loop past redesigned side chapels. Proceeding from north to south, from darkness to light, they'll encounter first the Old Testament, then the New, so as to enter progressively into the mystery of God, Chauvet said. Now, will that succeed? Well, thanks to the huge restoration budget, the cathedral should at least be looking sharp. Work that ordinarily would have stretched over decades is planned for the next 3 years. The entire inside of the church, including all the chapels and paintings and most of the stained glass, will be cleaned. Sparkling rebirth is, as if George Lynn thinks, the beauty of Gothic architecture is one of the best proofs of the existence of God. Then God will have risen to fight another day in France. The fire won't have been for nothing. That April evening, my wife and I were with old friends on their first trip to Paris. After dinner on the right bank, we decided to walk back to where we were staying on the left. The banks of the Seine were lined with people watching Notre Dame burn. Crossing the Ile de Saint-Louis, we stepped over a hose that the firefighters were laying to pump water from the river. On the Pont de l'Eternel, we stopped to hear an impromptu choir softly singing hymns to Our Lady. I've admired that view along with the Seine toward the apse of the Notre Dame dozens of times. I can't imagine that it would be like what it would be like to be gone forever. It was beautiful. One must stress the beauty of the fire, said Lenard. It was magnificent, but once it's beautiful, afterward it's ugly. There's only the ruin. At first there's only blackness, darkness, death, until it comes back to life again, as it must. Boy, quite an intriguing proposition there in the restoration of the great cathedral, huh? Well, the restoration of Notre Dame is one of many examples of what it takes sometimes to restore damaged historic sites frequently toured by tourists, or frequently visited by tourists, perhaps is better to say. Even more daunting, perhaps, is saving a site that's being challenged by climate change and other natural phenomena. Race is on to save the Great Salt Lake. Will it be enough? This article, written by Lindsay Whitehurst of the Associated Press, it appeared in the February 4th, 2022 online extra edition of the Raleigh News and Observer. So let's take a look at how they're trying to restore a very famous location, the Great Salt Lake. And the dateline, of course, is Salt Lake City. The largest natural lake west of the Mississippi is shrinking past its lowest levels in recorded history, raising fears about toxic dust, ecological collapse, and economic consequences. But the Great Salt Lake may have some new allies, conservative Republican lawmakers. The new burst of energy from the GOP-dominated state government comes after lake levels recently hit a low point during a regional mega-drought worsened by climate change. Water has been diverted away from the lake for years, though no to supply homes and crops in Utah. The nation's fastest-growing state is also one of the driest, with some of the highest domestic water use. This year could see big investment in the lakes that's long been an afterthought, with Governor Spencer Cox proposing spending $46 million and the powerful House Speaker throwing his weight behind the issue. But some worry that the ideas advancing so far at the state legislature don't go far enough to halt the slow-motion ecological disaster. One proposal would tackle water use in homes and businesses by measuring outdoor water that's considered some of the country's cheapest. Another would pay farmers for sharing their water downstream, and a third would direct money from mineral extraction royalties to benefit the lake. I long took for granted the lake. It's always been there, and I've assumed it always would be, said House Speaker Brad Wilson at a summit he convened on the issue. But learning about the lake's precarious position this summer left him terrified. The Great Salt Lake is in trouble. We have to do something, he said. The shrinking of the lake poses serious risk to millions of migrating birds in a lake-based economy that's worth an estimated $1.3 billion in mineral extraction, brine, shrimp, and recreation. Health risk exists, too. The massive lake bed could send arsenic-laced dust into the air that millions breathe. The Great Salt Lake needs some leaps to be saved. It's not going to do it with baby steps, said Zach Frankel, executive director of the nonprofit Utah Rivers Council. These are tiny baby steps that should have been taken 20 years ago, he added. The lake took a pummeling last year, with especially devastating effects on its microbiolites, the Great Salt Lake's version of a coral reef. The mushroom-like structures are formed by furry, deep green mats of microbes, which are the base of the lake's food chain and main sustenance for brine shrimp. The shrimp both support a multi-million-dollar industry supplying food for fish farms and nourish millions of migrating birds whose massive flocks can show up on radar. The lake is also the nation's biggest source of magnesium and could provide lithium, a key mineral for renewable energy batteries. But last year, the lake matched a 170-year record low and kept dropping, hitting a new low of 4,190.2 feet, or that's about 1,277.2 meters. This was in October. A significant portion of the microbiolites were exposed to air, killing the vital microbes. The die-off will likely take years and years to repair, even if they are fully submerged again, said Michael Vandenberg, a state geologist. And if the water levels continue to drop, the lake could get too salty for the edible microbes to survive, something that's already happened in the bright pink waters of the lake's north arm. Still, Vandenberg is cautiously optimistic for the south arm, where a portion of the green microbiolites did survive last year's lake drop. It's bad, but not catastrophic yet, he said. There's still time to fix and mitigate the situation. In some ways, the fix is simple. More water needs to flow into the lake. But that's no small task in the state that grew by 18.4% over the past decade to nearly 3.28 million people. Utah has relatively inexpensive water overall. A 2015 state audit found Salt Lake City water prices were lower than almost every other city surveyed, including Phoenix, Las Vegas, and Santa Fe. But a subset of homes have access to especially low-priced water, the cheapest in the nation, according to the Utah Rivers Council. About 200,000 homes and businesses pay a flat fee for an entire season of irrigation water. It's called a secondary water system made from converted agricultural supply in communities that are now largely suburban. Those account for a disproportionately large segment of the state's water use, and many of them are on the Great Salt Lake watershed, Frankel said. It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet, he said. While most people have a water meter on the side of their homes, usage isn't measured for secondary water users. But small-scale projects have shown that simply being aware of how much they're using makes people cut back by 20%, said GOP Utah Republican Tim Hawks, or Utah Representative Tim Hawks. There's been a pushback to change the system before, and part of the reason is the per-meter cost of about $1,500, but the governor has backed spending about $250 million in federal pandemic relief money to install them. The Utah Rivers Council would like to see people pay more for that water, but there's been little public discussion of that this year. Hawks argues that even conserving 20% through awareness would dramatically increase the chances that the lake stays healthy. This year is shaping up to be a wetter year than 2021, but that doesn't immediately translate to more water for the lake. First comes replenishing drinking water supplies, and then comes the lake, and homes and businesses aren't the only ones that need moisture. About 65% of the water on the Great Salt Lake watershed goes to agriculture. Farmers have a right to that water, and under historic laws, they could lose the water they don't use. Right now, there's actually a disincentive for agriculture to conserve or optimize the water they're using, said Republican Representative Joel Ferry. He's sponsoring legislation that would let farmers get paid for water they let flow to the Great Lake and other bodies. Because each farm is so much larger than the average home, even slight adjustments can have a major impact. Under his plan, which has advanced at the state legislature, it would be up to each farm to decide whether to sell water in a given year. The fund would also likely start with some federal pandemic money, and backers would hope to get donations as it continues. This is going to be a slow start, said Ferry, who is a farmer himself. We recognize there's a problem, and farmers want to be part of the solution. Ultimately, the solutions to this are going to be expensive, he said. The cost of doing nothing may be even higher. The draining of California's Owens Lake as Los Angeles grew has cost billions. Overseas, the Aral Sea became a source of toxic dust after its water was diverted away from the former Soviet Union. Experts estimate a drying Salt Lake, or rather Great Salt Lake, could cost Utah more than $2 billion every year. There's a real question about what happens next. Are we going to break through some critical thresholds here in the next little bit if we continue to go lower, Hawk said. If we act now, and we're thoughtful about it, there's a good chance we can keep the lake healthy and happy, and us along with it, he added. Kind of an interesting and very perplexing issue there in the Great Salt Lake. Well, as we continue on, we're going to continue with this theme of restoration with coastal volunteers raise oyster gardens to help restore reefs. Now, this article by Janet McConaughey of the Associated Press takes us to Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. It's one of the more than 1,000 locations nationwide where volunteers are raising oysters to rebuild reefs that are vital to local ecosystems. These locales also draw travelers who love marine life and their environs. So, why don't we take a look at what's going on as we head to Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. It's time to educate the oysters at State Stanislaus High School on Mississippi's Gulf Coast. Students on a platform below the school's long pier gently shake their oyster garden's wire cages as they pull them from the water, loosening mud and algae that might keep water and nutrients from baby oysters clinging to those shells. These students in Bay St. Louis are part of a volunteer force along U.S. coast that's raising oysters from translucent spat the width of a soda straw to hard-shelled bivalves that can help restore depleted reefs. Oyster reefs are a keystone of coastal ecosystems. Each oyster filters 25 to 50 gallons of water a day. Spat glue themselves to larger oysters and grow. The reefs provide habitat for shrimps, crabs, and fish, and protect shorelines. In Maryland, Virginia, Mississippi, and Alabama alone, there are more than 1,000 oyster gardens, most in wire cages, hanging from private docks or open-topped floats tied to them. Dennis Hatfield of Gulf Shores, Alabama, said he is struck each summer by the number of crabs, fish, shrimp, sponges, and other animals he clears from his cages on Little Lagoon. He says, I feel very positive we are creating habitat in the lagoon, adding that many of the 50,000 to 55,000 adult oysters grown there each year go to reefs in Mobile Bay. In the 1950s, an average of 37,400 tons of oysters were taken annually from the brackish waters nationwide. But over-harvesting, pollution, parasites, smothering sediment, and other problems saw U.S. oyster harvest fall 68% to about 11,900 tons a year in the 1990s, federal figures show. Commercial farmers around the country grow oysters near the surface because they mature much faster where the water holds more of the plankton they eat and predators can be more easily removed. Oyster gardening uses the same techniques on a smaller scale, but the oysters aren't being grown for the half shell or deep fryer. It's as much education as restoration, said Bob Stokes, director of the Galveston Bay Foundation in Texas. Volunteers become engaged about caring about the bay they live on, he said. When the little lagoon oysters were collected, more than 20 big plastic shrimp baskets held clumps of oysters, big enough to spawn next spring, but they're now on reefs being restored for fishing or reserved to hold brood stock for future generations with no harvest allowed. In the Mississippi Sound, heavy rains through spring and summer were hard on the baby oysters. Most shells in the cages set out in late June at St. Stanislaus held only silt in mid-October or mid-November, and surviving juveniles were generally less than an inch long. When you find one with an oyster, put it aside so you don't count them twice, cautioned Rain Palmer, an Auburn University graduate student who runs the Mississippi-Alabama Sea Grants Gardening Program in Mississippi. Empty shells also go into reefs, said Letha Bordreau, head of the Marine Biology Program in St. Stanislaus. Oyster shells are the hard surface spat prefer, and entire artificial reefs are made from recycled shells. The Galveston Bay program puts mesh bags holding recycled shells into the water to attract spat and give them a head start. Oyster gardening started in the late 1990s around the Chesapeake Bay, where harvest had plummeted 90% in two decades. The Mississippi-Alabama Sea Grants Oyster Gardening Program, modeled on the Chesapeake, started in Alabama in 2001 as master's thesis research, It makes me really happy to see that it took off and people are still doing it in Alabama, said Kimberly Henderson Hedrick, who won a Gulf Guardian Award in 2004 as head of Alabama's Shellfish Restoration Project and now teaches in the Indiana farm town where she grew up. The Chesapeake Bay oysters were beset by two highly lethal parasitic diseases in addition to other problems. Declines in the second half of the 1900s followed an even more drastic crash in the 1920s from rampant overharvesting, said Chris Moore, senior ecosystem scientist for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Gardeners in the foundation and its member groups have added at least 15 million oysters in Maryland and 1 million in Virginia, Moore said. Virginia's Tidewater Oyster Gardeners Association members grow oysters to eat as well as to plant. Tidewater hasn't been able to collect data on reef contributions, but President Emeritus Vic Spain thinks it's probably at least $500,000 a year. An umbrella group called the Chesapeake Oyster Alliance has set a goal of 10 billion added oysters by 2025. Wish us luck, that's going to be tough, Spain wrote in an email. Dozens of schools and community groups around New York Harbor have similar projects as part of the Billion Oyster Project, spokeswoman Helene Hedrick said in an email. Project does not call them oyster gardens because the harbor's oysters are unsafe to eat, and the goal is not food but restoration, she said. Oyster gardens get pulled from the water every week to 10 days to clear out critters, keep oysters from growing through cage mesh and dry out, and clean off algae and seaweed growing on the wire. And it can take oysters 3 to 4 years to reach adulthood in the Chesapeake and a year to 18 months in raised cages. And that, my friend, brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next week for our next episode. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.